The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Americans feeling the urgency of coronavirus and heeding advice to be prepared, but health officials say there are some crucial gaps.
We need to be able to test people. We currently do not have testing available widely around the country. Outside the CDC, as of Monday, only 5 places can test for this virus.
Also on that story, the Summer Olympics are scheduled for Tokyo, but a top Olympic official says maybe not.
You can't be unaware of the possibility that that may not happen.
And an Indian environmentalist saw a little boy picking plastic out of the trash.
I asked that guy, little boy, why are you collecting this from the trash can and what would you do out of it? He just replied me, food.
So the man opened the garbage cafe, turn in plastic waste, get a meal. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The coronavirus is popping up across Europe. Dozens of new cases were recorded today in Austria, Croatia, France, Germany, Greece, and Spain. Most of those cases were tied to Italy, which is struggling to contain an outbreak near Milan. In the U.S., only about 60 cases have been reported so far, but U.S. health officials say it's not a matter of if, but when the virus eventually spreads here. President Trump is addressing the nation this evening to talk about the situation. So what exactly do American hospitals need to do right now to prepare?
I think the hospitals need a unified national vision.
Nahid Bhadelia has dealt with past global health emergencies. Bhadelia is the medical director of the Special Pathogens Unit at Boston Medical Center. She worked in New York City during the H1N1 influenza pandemic in 2009 and during an Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Bhadelia says besides needing a national coordinated plan for how to prepare to respond to the virus, hospitals need basic supplies and equipment.
We need to ensure that there's continued supply of personal protective equipment. There's already shortages globally, not just in China, but in Europe and other places as well. Second, we need the ability to test for patients who might come in, because if you can no longer isolate them based on their travel history alone, they may look like any patient with influenza. And you need to be able to do a test very quickly to separate them from other people in the hospital.
So this new coronavirus, what we're seeing in China, is that one of the hardest groups hit in terms of infections are the health workers. How do you kind of factor that into preparedness here in the States?
I think it underscores the importance of how we need to stress routine infection control training and availability of resources for our healthcare workers. We have challenges at the healthcare facilities level, but I think that if you were to ask me, are we ready? I think we're less ready at the national policy level. You know, CDC has impressed me with the number of guidance documents they've put out. They've impressed me with how transparent they've been with staying ahead of calling this epidemic what it is and how it's growing currently. This week has meant a change in the way that we look at coronavirus. We're seeing it go from a pretty regional sort of epidemic to now sustained transmission in Italy, in Iran. Whether we call it or not, this is heading towards a pandemic. And the thing that's worrisome, again, going back to the national level, is that to get an accurate perspective of how big a problem this is in the United States, we need to be able to test people. We currently do not have testing available widely around the country. Outside the CDC, as of Monday, only 5 places can test for this virus. So do we really know how prevalent this disease is already in the United States?
Yes. So like at Boston Medical Center, what would you do if a person was suspected to have coronavirus and presented at the hospital?
Right now, the case definition for coronavirus from CDC is anybody who is presenting with symptoms consistent with the virus and travel to China. As Dr. Messonnier said from CDC, that's going to change. If we don't know how to find people based on where they are traveling from, this is going to be much, much more difficult. It's really anyone who comes in with symptoms that look exactly like influenza, which is why testing becomes so important.
Yeah.
The good thing is most people will not get very sick. From reports that we're getting from China, 80% of the people who get this get mild symptoms. I think the stress to the system is going to be those who actually do get sick from this disease and the burden that it's going to be placing on their health as well as our hospitals.
So talk about your involvement with the Ebola outbreak and how you think you can apply what you learned from the response in West Africa to preparing hospitals in the U.S. for an outbreak of new coronavirus.
during the West Africa epidemic on the national scene, the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response did a wonderful job of putting out funding and actually identifying hospitals that would serve both as treatment centers but also places where assessment can be safely done. That pool of money helped us basically ready a lot of hospitals, frontline facilities, for what might come not just during that epidemic but over the last 5 years, also allowing them to stockpile personal protective equipment. So in that way, I think that initial investment during the West Africa epidemic is helping us a little bit right now.
How many hospitals would you say are prepared right now for an eventual outbreak of coronavirus?
So the ASPR money, the Assistant Secretary in Preparedness, the HHS money, invested in 10 regional centers to respond to, you know, special pathogens, and then funded hundreds of assessment hospitals in response. But the difference is coronavirus is not the same disease as Ebola. It's a disease that has a lower mortality, but more people will get sick. More people are at risk, which means more people will seek health care in our hospitals. The challenge that we had with Ebola was someone who was coming in with a disease that has a really high mortality, but you're going to see one or two patients. Mm. The difficulty that we might face with coronavirus, which I think we're less ready to and prepared to respond to, is the fact that we might see hundreds of patients if worst-case scenarios are realized.
What about the lessons from H1N1 in 2009, which you also were working on in New York City in the hospitals there? What can you extract from that experience?
Very much sort of similar to what Nancy Messonnier, Dr. Messonnier from CDC said, which is that we're expecting what we saw in H1N1 to now play out with coronavirus, which is that we're going to see large numbers of patients coming into hospitals, but also community transmission. And what we learned from that experience is that when you have that many people sick, what you're doing is you're putting a stress on hospitals in terms of number of beds, in terms of availability of ICU beds. And it requires a lot more coordination at the public health level to ensure that the health care of not just those who are coming in sick with coronavirus, but also those of others who might be requiring care is not affected.
Dr. Naheed Bedelia, the medical director of the Special Pathogens Unit at Boston Medical Center. She's also worked on Ebola response in West Africa. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
No matter how you feel about the candidates on stage last night during the Democratic presidential debate in Charleston, South Carolina, I think we can all agree with Trevor Noah's assessment right after.
It was a little crazy.
Tom, I think she was talking about my plan, not yours.
I think we were talking about math, and it doesn't take 2 hours to do the math. Because let's talk about what it adds up to.
Let's talk about math.
Democrats all over the planet have been following the craziness, and they're not just watching to stay informed. They're watching because, even overseas, they have a say in their party's presidential nominating process. The world's Jorge Valencia has been spending time with Democrats abroad in Mexico City.
Here at this debate watch party last night, there's people drinking beers.
What you got going on over here?
Just some barbecue. It's pretty decent. I mean, I'm from North Carolina, so.
Brendan Cosgrove is a native of Western North Carolina, so he's partial to vinegar-based barbecue, though he's no harsh critic.
Well, I'll just say they do have very good ketchup-based barbecue. That's where I'll leave that.
So a bunch of American voters hanging out at a barbecue joint, watching the Democratic debate. Nothing unusual here. Except we are in Mexico City, and these voters will have their own primary.
It's a global primary. It's all Democrats living outside of the U.S. worldwide.
Ari Milner is a registered Democrat living here in Mexico, and he's referring to the Democrats Abroad primary. It goes on for 1 week, starting next Tuesday, which is one of the reasons Milner says he will vote in the Abroad primary instead of absentee in his home state of Oregon.
Most of our members are from states that participate much later in the primary process, but they can make their vote count more by voting earlier as a Democrat Abroad.
The other reason Milner gives is that Democrats Abroad get 21 delegates. That gives them a better voter-to-delegate ratio than voters in some states.
The chance is that if you vote as a Democrat Abroad instead of your state, your vote will probably count for more in the delegate ratio.
Democrats Abroad got their own convention delegates in 1976, the year Democratic nominee Jimmy Carter wound up defeating Republican Gerald Ford. They were allowed to do so thanks to a law President Ford signed a year earlier. Vernon Burton is a history professor at Clemson University.
Part of it was in the success of the Voting Rights Act.
Burton says the Overseas Citizens Voting Rights Act helped enfranchise Americans living outside of the country. And he says it's a legacy of African-American activists' efforts to gain voting rights a decade earlier.
My own theory is that this is a part of the success of the civil rights movement that says we're going to be an inclusive country. We're going to include everyone and want to make sure that these people who are Americans have the right to vote.
While Republicans supported overseas voting rights legislation, they never created their own abroad primary. These days, Democratic candidates court voters outside of the country. There were some 3 million eligible voters living abroad last election, according to the Federal Voting Assistance Program. The Bloomberg, Sanders, and Warren campaigns are organizing events in several countries. Sanders' brother, Larry, a longtime resident of Oxford, campaigns on Sanders' behalf and has been giving radio interviews in England and France.
Larry Sanders, you're very welcome to the program today.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Democrats vote on issues that aren't necessarily connected to the country where they're living now. For example, Shana Nielsen, who lives just outside Tel Aviv, does not vote on the issue of U.S.-Israel relations. She's more interested in U.S. tax law.
I'm taxed in Israel for things here, and I pay tax every year in the U.S.
Gordon Gall, who lives in Tokyo, says he cares about health care. One of the reasons he lives in Japan is that health care is more affordable there.
You know, it's not as good as some other countries that cover 100%, but still.
Cosgrove, the North Carolina native who prefers vinegar-based barbecue, has similar interests.
Personally, I care about Medicare for All, coming from a poor family. The Green New Deal, being a young person staring down climate catastrophe.
And for Ari Milner, who was also at the debate watch party in Mexico City.
I think for me, the main issue is just beating Trump.
There is no polling of American voters who live outside the country, but the results 4 years ago might provide a clue. In the 2016 Democrats Abroad primary, Bernie Sanders defeated Hillary Clinton by a landslide. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
Pro tip, put your smartphone into airplane mode if you want to charge it up twice as fast. Another pro tip, the world's stinkiest fruit can also be used to quickly charge your phone. That's according to a new study from Australia. As the BBC's Stephanie Prentice explains, stinky fruit batteries might also someday power your car.
Scientists at the University of Sydney have taken the inedible cores of tropical fruit, heated, then freeze-dried it, and used it to create, no, not an exciting cocktail garnish, but an aerogel. Imagine something that looks and feels like a very light sponge. Inside this sponge is a vast surface area, which can then be filled with an electrolyte, just like a normal battery. The aerogel then becomes a critical part of an energy storing device known as a supercapacitor. The fruits in question are the durian, which looks like a spiky pineapple and is known for its terrible smell, which the researchers in the study likened to festering roadkill, and the jackfruit, found on one of the world's biggest trees, usually in Southeast Asia. The unlikely energy sources can actually charge faster than a normal battery at times due to their structure. An ideal use for them is harvesting energy from braking systems in electric cars, which can then be transferred back to the standard battery if needed in a hurry. Basically, they're really good at charging quickly and then discharging energy quickly, but lack the longevity of a standard battery. Science professor Brian Dobby from the University of Manchester told me about the environmental benefits of the technology.
This is a waste product. So if you can make use of a waste product, that's spectacularly useful because normally you would use, to make these aerogels, you would use probably use oil, petroleum products from the ground, or possibly tar coming from coal. And so, of course, this would be a renewable source. We wouldn't be using something where there was carbon locked up in the earth, which would possibly contribute to global warming during the extraction. One of the whole ways in which we can get around the climate emergency is just being a lot more efficient at everything we do.
One of the limits to rolling out the idea globally would be only being able to grow the tropical fruits in the right climates. However, around the world, studies in other countries have used rice husks, tofu, and even garlic to charge devices like smartphones, and maybe even one day we could be using an apple.
But durian as a cocktail garnish? Maybe not. That's the BBC's Stephanie Prentice reporting there. Women around the world have long argued there should not be a sales tax on tampons and pads. Scotland is on the verge of taking that fight one step further. That's next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Even though half the population menstruates, talking about periods can be taboo. women and girls all over report stigma, shame, and discrimination around their periods. We are starting to see some progress around the world, though. In many places, it's becoming more acceptable to talk openly about menstruation. There's been more media coverage of the negative stereotypes, and a number of countries have abolished the sales tax on menstrual products. Then there's Scotland. It's on track to become the first in the world to provide free pads and tampons for everyone. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports.
The result of the vote is yes, 112. There were no votes against, and there was one abstention. The motion is therefore agreed.
And with that, the Scottish Parliament took a step closer to making history. The Free Period Products Bill would force the Scottish government to make sure that everyone who needs sanitary products can get them for free. During debate, the bill's sponsor, Monica Lennon, declared that menstruation is normal and free universal access to tampons and pads should be normal too.
Period dignity for all isn't radical or extreme. It's simply the right thing to do.
The Conservative-led Scottish government initially opposed the bill, but they did a U-turn last week. And yesterday, the bill sailed through the first stage of the parliamentary process. That doesn't mean there aren't issues, though. For example, lawmaker Graham Simpson said he had serious concerns about the expense.
We have no idea at all what any of this would cost. There's a huge disparity between what Monica Lennon said and figures, ludicrous figures actually, quoted by the government.
The government estimated the bill would cost taxpayers $31 million a year. That's more than two times Monica Lennon's original estimate. And then there's no clarity on how the pads and tampons will be distributed. Some lawmakers have proposed a voucher system where women can register for free products and then present a card or voucher to shops. Other lawmakers want to make tampons and pads available at designated public places like community centers and pharmacies. All these logistics will have to be ironed out now in this next stage of the legislative process. But there's some precedent. In 2018, there was a pilot project that gave free menstrual products to women in Aberdeen, and Scotland already provides free tampons and pads in schools, colleges, and universities. In other words, Scotland is already a global leader on this issue, and activist Victoria Heaney says that's because Scotland has strong feminist leadership across the board in politics, trade unions, and community groups.
We have a lot of women who are on the same page and who are willing to rise up over party lines and divides to actually create something that works for women.
Heaney says she hopes yesterday's vote inspires women around the world, women who are fighting to destigmatize menstruation in their own countries.
I definitely think it is setting an example to the world. Try and aim higher, you know, set your aspirations and go for it.
For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Imagine a home where the man has been arrested and detained. And while he's in prison, the authorities send someone to his home to live and make sure no one else is a criminal. That someone might even sleep in the man's bed next to his spouse. This is actually happening in China's Xinjiang region, where Uyghur Muslims are facing increasingly repressive government policies. When men are detained, Uyghur women are often left alone to keep their families and households together. The Pair Up and Become Family program assigns male Chinese minors to live in the homes of Uyghur families. The Chinese government says it's a cultural exchange.
They say it's kind of cultural understanding each other, but it's not really that. It's just one way.
That's Zubaira Shamsuddin, the Chinese outreach coordinator for the Uyghur Human Rights Project. She told me how policies like Pair Up affect Uyghur women in Xinjiang.
This kind of campaign is not new, but it was kind of intensified since 2016 with China's government's many other repressive campaigns against the Uyghurs. You know, from 2016, many Uyghur men sent to the concentration camps. So many women and the children left at home. And the Chinese government mobilized hundreds of thousands of party cadres to visit Uyghur families. At the beginning, it was kind of temporary, typically in the form of visits, like 5 days every 2 months. And whenever they visit, the family is required to provide information about their lives and the political views, the religious views. They just have to report everything. But by 2018, this campaign involved homestays. The officials actually stay at the homes and sleep with the family. That kind of homestay is really intrusive and it's insulting to Uyghur culture and religion.
That's kind of incredible. I mean, so these are party cadres, Communist Party loyalists who basically live in the homes of Uyghurs? I mean, how long do they stay and how many homes get visited by these cadres?
It is all over. According to the reports, south to north, every part of East Turkestan. And also, the thing is, that kind of homestay, they report that, you know, those officials speak to the children of the family because children, they don't lie. It's really absurd control of the Uyghur families.
I've seen some reports with quotes from Chinese officials, and I just wanted to get your reaction to this. When asked about not welcoming them or speaking out against the pair-up program, Chinese officials said the women are very keen and offer them whatever they have in their house. He also said that they have never heard of situations in which male officials take advantage of female members of the household, even though they often sleep in the same beds. Do you believe either of those claims?
No, I don't believe it. Because what I heard from Zumrat Dawood, who has, you know, personally, firsthand experienced that kind of homestay, they don't like it. I mean, nobody likes it because they are completely stranger, one. Secondly, it's attack on the family's privacy. It's just another form of jail for them.
The Chinese government continues to say that it's trying to re-educate and assimilate the Uyghur community. How does the Chinese government see the role of Uyghur women?
I think Uyghur women is very easy target. All men sent to the concentration camps. They don't have any other household male members who can support them. And the Chinese government is taking advantage of that difficult situation. The woman is very important for Chinese government. They think that if they completely assimilate Uyghur women, someone that listens to Chinese government and influence Uyghur people and society, that's why they target Uyghur women. The role of Uyghur women in Uyghur society is very strong. The target is not only changing Uyghur culture, it's changing Uyghur identity. In a word, it's another way of assimilation, of changing Uyghurs into Chinese.
Zubaira Shamsuddin, the Chinese outreach coordinator with the Uyghur Human Rights Project. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. A scientist preserving the seeds of fruits, vegetables, and grains wants us to welcome unfamiliar foods into our meals.
Can I open up the kinds of food I'd serve as my family and be more accepting towards diversity? And I think that would already help sort of build that resilience.
Growing more diverse foods can strengthen the planet's food supply. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. Back in 2017, the announcement sent Japan over the moon.
The 32nd Olympiad in 2020 are awarded to the city of Tokyo. Yeah!
Today, though, the cheering is on mute, thanks to worries about the games prompted by the coronavirus. The International Olympic Committee has not called off the games. Like the entire world, they're waiting to see what happens. But canceling the games is an option on the table. Dick Pound is a senior member of the International Olympic Committee.
We're all planning and hoping at the same time that July 24th will be the opening ceremony of an Olympic Games in Tokyo. But you can't be unaware of the possibility that that may not happen.
Hmm. Over the past couple of days, you've said both that the Tokyo Olympics will be business as usual. You've also said you have not made a final decision. Have you gotten any pushback for what sounds like mixed messages?
No, not really. I think people understand that there is something at play that is beyond the ability of both the IOC and the Tokyo organizers to deal with. Every day we'll know more about all the things that go into making a complicated decision on a complicated issue.
You've estimated that there is a 2 to 3 month window to decide the fate of the Tokyo Olympics. That means a final decision would come late May. So what factors are you going to be looking at when determining the actual threat of the coronavirus to the Tokyo Olympics? Are you working and monitoring with medical professionals?
Well, the date is not set in stone because with evolving knowledge and statistics, the perceptions may change a bit. You may be inside a month before you can say yes or no. What they're doing on a daily basis, if not hourly, is staying in touch with the WHO to try and get a handle on how the virus is spreading? What are the mortality rates as opposed to the cure rates? How much more toxic is this, if at all, than ordinary flu? And we just don't have enough data to make a reliable decision one way or another as we speak today.
So are you saying that it could be a few weeks out from the start of the Olympics and we still might not have a decision on whether they're happening or not?
It's possible. I mean, to the extent that there's any realistic possibility that the games will go on, you wait as long as you can to have a favorable outcome.
You've told the athletes to keep on training. You were an Olympic swimmer for Canada back in the day, Dick. Put us in the mind of an athlete right now. They've been training some their entire lives for this. What are you thinking as an athlete?
I think the athletes will say, please find a way to have these games take place. It's too important for everybody in the sports system to give them up.
Dick, are there options other than a full cancellation that you might entertain?
Well, I mean, there's a postponement option. If it looks like it's going to be tough for this year, we could engage the Japanese, for example, in a discussion. Could we do it in 2021? And if they say yes, then an option does open up. If they say it's got to be now or never, then you have to accept the possibility that the answer might be never.
Has there ever been a postponement of the Olympics?
Not to my knowledge. It's so complicated these days with, you know, satellite bookings and transportation and security and all that, that the games are supposed to start on July 24th at 8 o'clock. You know, it's not 8:05 and it's not July 25th.
So the IOC will be watching. If today was the start of the Olympics, how would you feel?
Today, I would say I would feel nervous, but the outbreak in Japan has been relatively minor, and the mortality figures are really quite small. And so I think that a good quarantine operation would make the games possible. Where I would be worried about would be the crowds and where the crowds are coming from.
Should athletes feel nervous?
Well, athletes will be in more of a bubble, and they will not have been exposed to the virus during their training, because otherwise they would not be there. But, you know, all you need are two or three in a contained village like the Olympic Village to increase the risk that it would spread, and it clearly spreads quite easily.
Dick Pound, a senior member of the International Olympic Committee. He represented Canada as a swimmer at the Rome 1960 Olympics. Dick, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for mentioning that year.
Thank you very much.
Anytime.
Universities in the U.S. get funding from a number of places, alumni, grants, and yes, countries. China gives some big money to American colleges, but the Trump administration is taking a close look at funding from China because it suspects widespread economic espionage. The federal scrutiny into Chinese and international funding is disrupting the work of scholars who are used to working with colleagues and institutions across the world. Kirk Carapeza covers higher education for our partner WGBH here in Boston. Here's what he found.
Good morning.
At the federal courthouse in Boston recently, government prosecutors charged the head of Harvard's chemistry department with lying about research funding he got from the Chinese government. U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling said Charles Lieber signed a contract with a Chinese university and was paid up to $50,000 a month to set up a research lab and develop batteries for electric cars. Lieber is being accused, though, of hiding his contract from Harvard and federal agencies.
Lieber also joined China's Thousand Talents Plan, a Chinese government-run program designed to entice scientists and researchers in the United States to share their research expertise with China.
Lelling said China uses these partnerships and exchanges with U.S. schools to steal cutting-edge research and equipment. The government estimates this costs the U.S. at least $200 billion a year.
Boston is an especially attractive target for this kind of exploitation, and universities must become sensitized to this threat.
Lieber's attorneys declined an interview, and they haven't offered a defense yet about what he was doing in China. The case is raising big questions about academics used to cross-border collaboration. The mission of research universities in the U.S. is to discover and share knowledge. A federal crackdown on foreign funding threatens to undermine that openness.
It's a tense time for the American research community.
Rebecca Kaiser directs the National Science Foundation's Office of International Science and Engineering. She says the Lieber case is a warning to colleges. Police yourselves and be more vigilant about potential espionage.
We're all struggling to really understand the scope and scale of this issue. And we know there is an issue out there. We just need to work together to figure out what to do about it.
Kaiser says universities are exploring how to balance scientific collaboration with research security.
The science is better when we all work together.
Kaiser recommends universities create a know-your-collaborator culture of transparency on campus, and she suggests Lieber cross the line.
There's a difference between collaboration, where there's true intellectual cooperation between parties, and what we're talking about here. This type of foreign influence is not collaboration.
Both the National Science Foundation and National Institutes of Health do allow professors to engage with universities abroad, but require they disclose it.
There's nothing inherently wrong with foreign recruitment programs, per se.
Julia McKenzie is the head of international affairs at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. She says cases like the one involving the Harvard professor paint a bleak picture of systematic threats to U.S. research from the Chinese government.
But that's a very difficult thing for any individual university to assess. There are very important questions about how to balance such a threat with other real issues such as racial profiling.
Some academics worry about a new Red Scare on campus as the Trump administration tries to confront national security threats presented by China. This could mean unfairly targeting Chinese researchers and those who work with them. Although most academics swept up in these investigations are Chinese nationals, Harvard scientist Charles Lieber is an exception. He's white. At a conference in D.C. this month, FBI Director Christopher Wray said China is waging a generational fight to beat the U.S. when it comes to economic and technological leadership.
But not through legitimate innovation, not through fair and lawful competition, and not by giving their citizens the freedom of thought and speech and creativity that we treasure here in the United States.
Instead, Wray argues the Chinese government is willing to steal its way up the global economic ladder. In court, a federal judge released Lieber on a $1 million cash bond. Harvard also placed Lieber on paid administrative leave, and a grand jury will decide whether to indict him. For The World, Kirk Carapeza, Boston.
One more story about money from China. Hong Kong's legislature announced this morning that it will put serious cash in the hands of each of the city's residents. $1,200 cash money for every adult. Here's Paul Chan, Hong Kong's financial secretary, announcing the news. He said the Legislative Council wants to encourage Hong Kong's consumer economy and also ease people's financial stress. Hong Kong's economy has been battered by months of violent clashes between police and pro-democracy protesters. Add to that the impact of the coronavirus on Hong Kong's economy. Paul Chan says the city will spend about $71 billion to put money in the pockets of about 7 million people. More the waste, better the taste. That's the motto at a cafe in India. Not just any cafe, the garbage cafe. So here's the concept. Bring in a kilogram of plastic trash, about 2 pounds worth of plastic, and you get a free hot meal. Zishan Khan is an environmentalist and founder of the Garbage Cafe. Did I explain the formula correctly? A kilo of plastic trash and you get a free hot meal?
Yeah, if you bring in the 1 kg of plastic, we provide you with a full meal. And if you bring in the 0.5 kg, we provide you with snacks in exchange at the cafe.
And it's any kind of plastic? It doesn't have to conform to specific recycling requirements or anything?
For now, we are accepting all kind of plastic, but in future, we are segregating it. We are, when people get aware of it, we'll be doing the segregation and try to bring them the separate plastics as well.
And what do you do with the plastic waste afterwards? Is it recycled?
Yeah, it went to the recycling center. We are sending it to the recycling centers, and the revenue is coming in to cater all the expenses at the cafe.
Your cafe opened several months ago in October. What's happened since then? How popular has it become?
It has become very popular and it has been spreading all across India. And there are more people who want to open this cafe in their own region. And it has been widely spreading all across the world. There's one in Milan, Italy. They also want to open up with the same idea of garbage cafe.
And they are getting that idea in Italy because of what you're doing in India?
Yeah, they are constantly in touch with me and we are sharing the ideas and all the necessary do's and don'ts. We are sharing it and we are implementing it all across the world.
So in addition to this novel idea at the Garbage Cafe, you're also finding kind of a faith-based way to encourage recycling. Explain that.
Yeah, so we are coming up with this new idea called Plastic Donation Center. We are working to get rid of plastic waste. We are urging people to donate their plastic waste, which we are upcycling for the city beautification by making waste to art installations. And also we are selling it to generate revenues, which is used for the welfare of the society and also generating employment for the deprived section of the society. India has a diversity of religious beliefs and practices. Donation is considered as a major belief. So we have connected this donation thing with the plastic waste. So we are urging people to donate.
Yeah, so basically you're appealing to that generosity that's embedded in Hinduism and Islam.
Right, truly, absolutely.
India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi said he wants to phase out single-use plastics by 2022. What role is the Garbage Cafe playing in achieving that goal?
From the time it started back in 2014, Clean India Mission has become a vibrant mass movement now. The mission has contributed to India's reaching the Sustainable Development Goals. And the government's next big priority after achieving the aim of building 100 million toilets is to phase out single-use plastic now. And as you said, our Prime Minister has announced to give up single-use plastic on the 150th anniversary of Gandhi in 2019. Mm. Since then, policy-level work is going on and the government are actively spreading awareness among the citizens.
So I imagine you're hopeful about seeing an India that's free of single-use plastics by 2022, but what are the obstacles to that happening?
What we are facing, the challenge, is the lack of awareness among the people, because there are awareness in the urban areas, but in rural areas, there is a very lack of awareness. So what we are doing is we are educating them. We are building the plastic warriors. We have introduced this another program called Plastic Warriors. We are training the certain amount of people and they are then training the next group of people. So we are spreading the awareness by doing this.
As for you, Zeeshan, what got you into tackling plastic waste in India specifically?
I was at a cafe with my friends and I saw this guy, this little boy who was picking up the plastic from the trash can. And I asked that guy, little boy, why are you collecting this from the trash can and what would you do out of it? He just replied me, food. And that's it. I was shook by the words of him and I didn't sleep the whole night and I researched on it.
Wow. So it was just seeing that kid in the street picking up plastic and saying he's going to use it to get food.
Yeah. So it completely changed my mind and I fully, completely dedicated, worked on it and come up with these two ideas of Plastic Donation Center, the Garbage Cafe.
Zeeshan Khan is an Indian environmentalist. He's the founder of the Garbage Cafe in Ambikapur. Thanks very much, Zeeshan, for the interview, and thanks for your work.
Thank you so much for inviting me here. Thank you.
In case of catastrophe, natural or man-made, protecting global food supplies is essential. That's the mission of the Svalbard Global Seed Vault in Norway. Since 2008, they've been collecting and storing seeds from all over the world. Biodiversity is important to food production, and the vault is meant to protect that at all costs. This week, the Global Seed Vault reached a milestone. It officially has 1 million different varieties of seeds in storage. Hannes Dempewolf is a senior scientist with the Crop Trust, which helped create the Svalbard Global Seed Vault.
The vault in itself has capacity to store about 4.5 million seed samples. The vault is now 12 years old, and we think we're a bit under halfway there. So the 1 million mark is a very significant achievement for the vault.
So I see that some seeds came from Highgrove, that's Prince Charles's private farms and estates. Some of the new seeds also came from the Cherokee Nation. How is it decided which seeds from all over the world will be stored at the vault? Are we talking fruits and vegetables or like all plants in the world?
We're talking about all seeds that are considered useful for food and agriculture. So this is not wild plants that don't have sort of a clear human use, but things that are cultivated and eaten by humans or domesticated animals. We don't distinguish whether this is a particular tomato or potato or apple. We don't prefer certain varieties over others. It's all about the uniqueness of the material that we hope to back up here in the seed vault in Svalbard.
What does it look like inside the seed vault? I mean, how are the seeds actually stored and cataloged?
The seed vault is a backup facility for other seed banks, and as such, the seed banks submit their seed samples in boxes. So once these boxes arrive at the vault, they're brought deep into this tunnel on the mountainside here in Svalbard, about 130 meters drilled into the rock face, and they're put up in these large chambers. There's about three big chambers. One of them is almost full now, the floor-to-ceiling compartments where these boxes are stored, and that's where they basically sit until the seed depositor would request them back again.
When was the most recent episode where a country said, hey, we need some of those seeds back?
The first and only so far happened in 2015, where the International Seed Bank of ICARDA, that was based in Aleppo, Syria, decided that they had to withdraw their materials because they could no longer operate in Aleppo due to the civil strife in Syria. And so they reestablished their seed collection in Morocco and Lebanon, and over successive years withdrew tens of thousands of samples, regrew that material to multiply it again, and then send it back up for safekeeping up here in Svalbard. And in fact, this most recent shipment that was deposited yesterday included some of those seeds that were redeposited from Morocco, which is, I think, an interesting story in itself.
So basically, the Svalbard Global Seed Vault is ensuring the world has enough food production in the future. What do you think are the biggest challenges to ensuring seed diversity around the globe?
I think there is a lack of understanding. There's a lack of political will in some cases. Most seed banks are just left up to project money. And, you know, that runs out in a couple of years, and then they have to switch off their freezers and all that diversity is gone. That cannot happen. This material is way too valuable to be left up to these funding uncertainties. But of course, there's also challenges around the way we do agriculture. The industrialized agriculture is our dominant way we do agriculture, and that does mean varieties are being lost and replaced by uniform crops. That is certainly an issue and contributes to this ongoing loss of genetic diversity. But we're also seeing crop replacement. You know, climates are changing, environmental conditions are changing rapidly for many farmers around the world, and that means they often have to adopt new varieties that can cope with these challenges better, which means some of those old ones, they just stop growing and they are lost. And this is an irreparable loss. Every time this happens, you can't bring it back, which again is why it's so important that these seed banks exist and do their work all around the world.
Hannes Deppewolf, senior scientist with the Crop Trust. Thanks for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
All right, here's something for you soccer fans out there. The game is about to go through some pretty big changes. The World's Amanda McGowan tells us how.
There are few things more dramatic in soccer than a ball being headed into the net.
Vucevic finds Marosevic. Header is in!
But that move has been banned for players ages 11 and younger in England, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. The ban comes on the heels of a study from the University of Glasgow in Scotland. It says that former professional footballers, as they're known in the UK, are 3.5 times more likely to die from dementia than the general public. Dr. John McLean is the Scottish Football Association's chief medical consultant.
This is a sensible, pragmatic approach to try and reduce that overall burden and at the same time continuing to improve head injury management.
Under the new guidelines, young children will be banned from heading during practice. During games, it's still okay. Older children will have a phased introduction to heading between the ages of 12 to 16. Heading in youth soccer was actually banned in the United States a few years ago, but in the UK, banning heading altogether might be a third rail that Britain's soccer-obsessed society is not willing to contend with yet. On Twitter, former English player Jamie O'Hara said, "Heading a football is a skill that is essential to becoming a footballer. How do they propose they learn this if they're not allowed to head a ball?" Still, some big-time footballers are coming out in support of this idea. After the announcement was made, Scottish soccer legend Alan McLeish admitted that he gets tested for brain disease. He says the new rules could actually be good for the game by increasing a focus on building technical skills.
It could be a significant difference for young players growing up in terms of the manipulation of the ball on the ground.
The lead researcher on the University of Glasgow study, Dr. William Stewart, sees the ban as a sign that soccer may finally be willing to contend with the growing body of scientific evidence.
You know, other sports have been changing, and football is the one sport which has been resistant to change for reasons I don't understand for many years.
Still, some wonder if the new rules go far enough. The Brain Injury Association, HEADWAY, applauded the decision, but they questioned whether the ban on heading should be extended to adults too. Dr. Stewart agrees.
I'd like to see, you know, something looked into in terms of adults and professionals. Maybe we could cut back on training exposure to head impact. And I'd like to see the management of head injuries in football significantly improved than where it is right now.
Still, some are conflicted. Chris Sutton is a former professional football player, as is his father. He says his dad suffers from CTE, a degenerative brain disease caused by repeated head injuries. But Sutton says don't change the game altogether.
I don't want heading banned. I don't think my dad would want heading banned, but I think this is a step in the right direction.
He supports the heading ban for kids only. Still, he says, if he knew then what he knows now, he might have played the game differently. For The World, I'm Amanda McGowan.
And that's where we sign off today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.